Stephen Colbert here to tell you about the Late Show Pod Show, which is our podcast for the Late Show with my producer, Becca. Becca, how long have you been producing this podcast?
I've been producing this podcast for 2 years now.
And your favorite thing about it?
The extended moments, for sure.
Right, because sometimes I'll interview like a big star for 25 minutes, and we can only put like 14 minutes on air. Where can people get that?
On the Late Show Pod Show with Stephen Colbert, wherever you get your podcasts.
And who produces that?
I help out. It's a team effort.
You're listening to Comedy Central.
So, how to be a young anti-racist? That means you're already banned in Florida. So, it's funny when we talk about race, because we live in a country that the Congress and Senate voted for a Juneteenth bill. But we're the same nation that doesn't want to talk about slavery. They'll have Martin Luther King and Robert E. Lee Day on the same days. So I think when it comes to racism, I think that a lot of people believe that if they're not actively saying the N-word or doing or saying bigoted things, that means they're not racist. So how can we start a conversation about being anti-racist when you're not quite sure how to quantify racism? We are, but I don't think a lot of people are.
And I think that's the very point. Because if you're not doing anything to challenge all of the injustice and all of the inequity in our society, then what happens? It persists.
Sure.
So therefore, you're reinforcing it. So therefore, you're being racist. And so we're encouraging people to actively try to dismantle this structure, including young people.
But what is their incentive? Like, what would they be Nick, what is their... If this system is working for you or not, it doesn't cause you any ruffles. You can sleep at night. Why would you want to change a system that doesn't... that seems to be going just as you intended?
But is it actually working for you?
Well,
right?
A lot of people, yeah.
It
yeah.
seems
not me.
To be.
I'm,
right?
Yeah.
It clearly is not
I'm
working for either one of us.
I'm talking about, like...
Yes. I think, for me, it's all about children, right? Like, even though this is a system that might seem like it's working for you, the world is actively changing. If your children are not prepared to live in a world and move through a world that have people that are different from them in positions of power, they're going to be in trouble.
Yeah, but then they try to remake the world. You see that. They literally, we're a nation that is run by the Flintstones and the Jetsons. And the Flintstones are winning. You have to understand that I don't believe a lot of people, for instance, I don't believe white people, a lot of white people are actively racist. But I do believe that the notions of white supremacists, they don't agree with their methods, but they agree with their goal, which is to keep white people in charge. Mm-hmm. And so if that is the premise, then what incentive, seriously, would there be to make these changes that only destabilize what you know works for you?
I think one of the things we've been showing in studying racism is that it's actually harming white people, too. It's not harming them at the level it's harming people of color. But there are actually white people who are dying of police violence. They're not dying at the level of black and brown people, but more white people are dying of police violence in this country than other countries. More white people are incarcerated in this country than other countries. More white people are struggling to vote in this country compared to other countries. There were 5 million about poor whites in 1860 whose poverty was directly connected to the enslavement of black people.
But I think a lot of white people don't get this. When you poor, you a nigga too. You are. Like, that, I don't think people understand
no,
that
they
generally
don't.
What hurts me hurts you. What is good for me is good for you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, but there is that thing and where you know, people will give their last dime to keep things a certain way as long as it hurts you. Like, look at what happened with the Obamacare Act. A lot of those people in those poor states are being hurt by that, but they don't care as long as you are.
Yeah.
And but the sense of optimism is in what you said earlier, children. Because in children you have, not mine, they're a whole different thing, but but in our children we can see the potential of things that we hope we could realize but probably never will. So that is an angle I think that is probably substantive.
Yeah, I think when it comes to children, I have two of my own, mm-hmm. and it's important for me that they enter a world that they feel empowered to change, which is why we wrote this book, right? So Dr. Kendi wrote his memoir years ago, and I latched onto it, slid into his DMs, and asked if I could do a young reader's version, because it's important that young people have the tools. I get so many kids who are asking, well, what do I do? How do I help? What do I change? How can I get into this fight and do something about it? And so creating a text like How to Be a Young Anti-Racist, we're giving them information where they're learning these definitions or learning what racism
give me an example of what racism actually is.
So racism is a system of ideas. So you have racist ideas, sure. And they are basically, they're made to keep inequities going.
Right?
So the whole purpose of a book like How to Be a Young Anti-Racist is to give young people terms that we can all agree on. That way we know what we're standing against.
Like what?
Like racism. Having a term, a definition for racism helps them see, okay, this is what we're trying to fight.
Because one of the things that happens is people who have historically been racist refuse to define that term.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
Because it allows them to exonerate themselves consistently and constantly. And even young people, therefore, don't know what it is. So they can't even assess themselves and guide themselves.
How would they know? We have a lot of people who are raised by people who moved out of places that black people were moving into.
Yeah.
Right? That was a predicate. We're going to move out of places that black people are moving into. But those are the people who have the conversation with the people who are now having the conversation with the people. So if they don't think the thing that they did was racist, that's a level of obliviousness that you can't quite quantify.
It is. And indeed, the heartbeat of being racist is denial. And this denial is consistent and constant and insidious.
You know, it does give me hope when I see people, like your book beat my book on the New York Times bestseller list. Get the set. No, I'm just kidding. And it's interesting because it came along at a time, and you had written it a good while back, but it resurfaced when the George Floyd protest was coming on. There really seemed a moment, and there seemed these inflection points when we can generally, well, people are really open to listen, but the problem is, it's so fast. Mm-hmm. You can only get attention so fast, and then we're on to the next thing. And I think that's not even purposeful. I think it's just a function of how we live. But if you could say a substantive thing that people could do every day, like in practice, every day, where they could be an example, because every time somebody says something that somebody deems hurtful, they automatically stop. I don't want to hear it anymore. I'm tired of this already. We were a slave for 400 years, but Jim Crow been around 50 years. Like, trying to not be a slave has not, we haven't had to put as much elbow grease into that. But books like this and having conversations where people don't turn off are really the crux of what we need to be doing. Mm-hmm. And for young people, it's so much easier to, like it is to learn a language. It's got to be easier to learn a love language, right? It's got to be easier to learn.
Yeah.
And what do I, because I get angry.
Yeah.
Like when black people do it, it's called anger. When white people do it, it's called righteous indignation. But it's really hard to come from a place of anger and try to teach somebody something.
Yeah.
So I think, at least on me, the onus has to be lowering the temperature and listening, right?
Yeah, and I mean, look, the book is really all about first turning inward. I think part of the issue is that we don't do a good job of humanizing ourselves. We don't give ourselves the space to be angry. We don't give ourselves the space to be sad. We don't give ourselves the space to have unpopular opinions, right? Like we do,
I do.
We're all, you do. But even that, you know, the fact that you're like, I'm angry and I don't know how I feel about being angry. Like it makes sense that we're angry. Mm-hmm. So taking the time to look inward and figure out the beauty of How to Be an Anti-Racist, the adult book, was that you get Ibram's whole story where he is very open about the racist ideas that he was holding. Mm-hmm. So taking that and distilling it down for young people so that they can see, oh dang, this thing that I'm thinking is probably a little racist. We had an event last night in Atlanta, and our team moderator, that was the first question she asked us. She was like, I read the book, and it pointed out to me all of the ways that I have racist ideas, and it made me feel a way about myself. What am I supposed to do? So then having that self-compassion where you can see, okay, yes, I am a product of a racist environment. I probably have some racist ideas. Mm-hmm. Taking the time to give yourself some grace, you'll give other people some grace, too. And that's how we kind of, like, get to a point where we're working together
to
dismantle things.
At least hearing each other.
Yeah.
The thing that's so frustrating for me is our stories tend to start in the middle. Mm-hmm. Like, we were something before this, and our stories seem to start in the middle. So, and it's just like even what's going on in Florida, you don't even want us to learn our history. Like, there was a time when enslaved people couldn't learn, and now it's illegal for us to learn about enslaved people.
Yeah.
So...
You spitting, boy.
And you would have heard that had you not beat me on the New York Times bestseller list. That. And I think that we have a lot to learn about how things work and to really have constructive conversations, because it's so much more fulfilling to me to shout at somebody, but it doesn't really accomplish anything. And I'm really very proud that you write books like this. And I think the younger you start, I mean, you got to not be an anti-racist baby. You have the babies, too? You have the baby?
Yeah, we got the anti-racist babies.
What the f*** is a baby going to do? Like,
hey, look, you learn it somewhere. You either learn to love people or you learn to hate them, right? Like,
I don't want chocolate milk. I want... How to Be a Young Anti-Racist and the Young Anti-Racist workbook are available now.
Explore more shows from the Daily Show podcast universe by searching The Daily Show wherever you get your podcasts. Watch The Daily Show weeknights at 11, 10 Central on Comedy Central, and stream full episodes anytime on Paramount Plus.
This has been a Comedy Central podcast.
Survivor 46 is here, and so is On Fire, the only official Survivor podcast, and we have a twist this season. The winner of Survivor 45, Dee Valladares, will be joining us every week.
We're going behind the scenes of the biggest moments, the how and the why things happen, and the strategy and analysis you can only get from someone like me, a Survivor winner.
Listen to On Fire, the official Survivor podcast, on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.